Howdy there, CNFers. Hope you're having a CNF and good week. I snagged you a great guest this week. Luck on my part and generosity on the part of one Roy Peter Clark, America's writing coach, scholar, and author of 5 books on writing in the past 10 years. That would be Writing Tools, The Glamour of Grammar, Help for Writers, Writing Short, and The Art of X-Ray Reading. I'm going to repeat that. 5 books in 10 years. I revisit them all the time to sharpen the saw. And each time I revisit, say, Writing Tools, I become a better and better writer. I can't recommend them enough. So in this episode, you'll learn a lot about Roy and how Roy came to live inside the language, and how those early experiences led him, ultimately, to the Poynter Institute, where he was able to coach and influence a nation of writers. Now, I debated whether to break this up into 2 episodes, but decided to leave it as one lump sum. I think you'll get a lot out of it. You can do it in one sitting, or visit it piecemeal. I do hope you'll share this episode with others. Subscribe if you haven't already to hashtag CNF. Rate it if you haven't already, etc., etc. So thanks for listening, guys. Now just sit back and enjoy the one and only Roy Peter Clark. Well, this is so wonderful that I get a chance to speak with you. I've been such a fan of your work for so long, and I'm just really grateful and thankful that you're able to carve out some time here to talk shop. So thanks so much for doing that.
No, listen, it's my pleasure, and I appreciate your kind words.
Well, so now it being 2017, your first official year of retirement, I wonder, What goals have you put in place to approach this new frontier?
Well, it's a very complicated issue, and it's a complicated process. So I thought that I might. So I'm gonna my 69th birthday is next Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And as I imagined, and this year is the 40th anniversary of my coming to St. Petersburg to begin working as a newspaper writing coach, and then finally over to the Poynter Institute. So originally I thought that I might work full time for Poynter until I was maybe about 72. So another 3 years. I had plenty of energy, plenty of stuff to do. I think that what persuaded me to retire is a kind of mostly a feeling of timing, that in terms of your commitment to a particular institution, especially in an era now when very few people are spending, working 20, 30, 40 years for the same employer, that there's a kind of a natural order of things in which it's time to sort of step aside and let the younger creative folks at a place like Poynter step up and assume responsibility for sort of leading it into the future. Gene Patterson, who was my mentor, would sometimes be asked questions about what should we do? What should we do? What about the future of newspapers? This and that. And he'd say, ladies and gentlemen, it's your turn. and so that was that was the primary incentive for changing my role at Poynter. Now, I kind of liked the way that certain athletes, like baseball players, like Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera, would announce that this was their last year and have a kind of a victory tour, and so Poynter, I've signed a contract with Poynter for this year to work on certain important projects that have always been part of my passion for being here and working here. So although I'm no longer a full-time employee, I'm at Poynter most of the time. Poynter.org remains my primary outlet for publishing work. I wrote a piece a couple of days ago about Donald Trump's use of quotation marks. I wrote a piece that's running today, a kind of reflection on the life and career and influence of Jimmy Breslin. Mm. I'm thinking of writing I was very influenced growing up by the music of Chuck Berry, and he's now passed. So I've got things to do. I've got things to write. Over the last few months, the ESPN website called The Undefeated, which is a website about sports and culture and race and politics, and so I've written a half dozen pieces for them. They're looking at another one. So I find that I'm not retired in that sense. I'm just not working full-time for Poynter anymore.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like retirement these days isn't quite what it used to be. It's not like going out to seed or anything. A lot of people are just really keeping up, mm-hmm. doing the work, and it sounds like you're as busy as ever.
It feels that way, and I do think, you know, I've come to admire people who, I've not used this metaphor before, but, you know, sort of, you know, when you're a certain age, it doesn't mean that, for example, you have to leave your family, right? Mm-hmm. That you're no longer a member of your family. Or when you're a certain age, it doesn't mean that you can no longer be a member of the church or of the chess club or whatever. And so there are these passions you have and these values that you develop and some practices to which you're attached, and whether they're golf or music or writing or reading, these are things that you can do to the end of your life. There's one of the most famous musicians and inventors was a man who died about 3-4 years ago, Les Paul. So Les Paul invented, or was one of the inventors of, the electric solid body guitar. And Les Paul, at the age of, until he was 91 or 92, was playing one night a week at a little jazz club in New York City. And young guitar players, some of them, you know, stars in their own right, would show up and play gigs with him. And a man named William Zinsser, a writer and an editor, who wrote a very influential writing book called On Writing Well. I wrote a piece celebrating his 90th birthday, and he was blind by the time he was 90, and he was living in an apartment in New York City, and he was still doing a couple of things. He would have writers who would come visit him, and even though he couldn't, like, see their stories, he would coach them and edit them and tutor them in some way. And in addition, he had a young poet who would come in, and it was giving him, like, poetry lessons, like, into his 90s. And he and I exchanged some messages where he said to me, you know, let's keep this mission going. Hmm. And that, to me, was this mission to, you know, our attachment to the craft, storytelling, reading and writing, ultimately, you know, freedom of expression. You know, those have become my role model. So 20 years from now, I'll be 89. My mom lived until she was 96. So if I live till 90, I hope that year I'm still learning something about the craft and I'm still helping in some way, if I can, if I have the capacity to do that. And that's, you know, that's a fortunate place to be.
Yeah, and you bringing up the way, you know, Zinsser couldn't he couldn't see anymore and read in the traditional sense, but he was still coaching basically by ear. And that's something you write about a lot, is that auditory nature of pros and everything. So it's one of those things where it can really, your coaching style can and skills can still evolve as maybe one sense depletes, another one can sort of increase to fill its void.
Yeah, and there are some famous blind authors. I'm thinking, John Milton, I think, wrote Paradise Lost. I think he was blind by that point. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
James Joyce, was blind. And it's very interesting to think of these authors who they didn't have voice recognition technology, but they had secretaries. I don't mean in the traditional sense. I mean, I think they're called, I think the technical word for this person is an emanuensis, E-M-A-N-U-E-N-S-I-S. You have to look that up. But I think an emanuensis is the kind of person who comes in, and you've been up all night thinking and memorizing this poetry, and then you dictate it, and somebody else writes it down for you.
Yeah.
And so written language is very, very late in human history.
Right.
And so the spoken word, precedes it by millennia, as the storytelling and other related capacities.
Now, it's something that you write about in the introduction to Glamour of Grammar. You note that you've been you encourage people, anyone who would actually pick up and buy that book is living in the language, and that's something that you kind of repeat throughout that introduction, and that living in the language. I wonder where did that come from for you when you were growing up.
I just happened to have this little. I wasn't planning this, but I'm reaching out right now, and I happen to have it nearby, and it's a really precious family document, and it's what used to be called a baby book. And so 3 days after I was born, a family that knew my family gave my mom this baby book, and what it is a little velveteen covered keepsake in which a mom will write things and keep things. And so there are photographs. This actually, I'm looking at a little lock of my hair, which is kind of scary. I wish I still had it. It has things about my first words, first little picture that I drew. It's quite a little treasure chest. There's this particular place that makes me laugh every time I read it. It says mother's notes, and it says age 16 months, right? So 16 months, I'm a mathematician, so I know that's 1 year, 4 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my mom writes, Roy is at the talk of the neighborhood. He can speak more than any child his age. He can sing every other word of Seesaw, Jack and Jill, and I'm looking over a four-leaf clover. Besides a wonderful vocabulary, mimics everything and everybody, okay? Then it says age 24 months, so I'm a terrible two-year-old. The fact that I haven't written anything for 8 months should speak for itself. Roy is a real boy, and all of my time is spent running around after him. He can recite the entire alphabet, can read the letters A, E, F, W, M, and L. Not bad, huh? Still sings all day long. So look, I cannot even, this is a time before my memory exists, right? I mean, I don't have any capacity yet. My brain hasn't evolved to the point where I can remember what I was doing at age one or two. And there, imprinted as a result of nature or nurture, is a love for language and a love for music. And I play music in almost every workshop, a writing workshop that I do.
Mm.
So it's really funny and eerie and a little humbling to know that because of the way that you came in the world, that your life with language was somehow determined.
Yeah. Yeah, you just had a capacity for it.
Had a capacity, had people who nurtured it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I was read to, I was sung to. I was part of a big Italian-American family on my mother's side. They were talkers, they were storytellers. They're very expressive, very loving. So as a result of all those things, I wound up and still am living a life of language. Once again, not just that I have this capacity, but that I have this passion. And the world would be better if more people could find a way to make that step, to make that leap, to cross the bridge from having language in you to having the ability to kind of swim around and play around inside the language.
Do you remember some, as you were in grammar school, elementary school, what were some of those maybe influential, real early books that people put in your hands? Because you had the propensity to sort of speak and hear the language before you even knew what it was, essentially. And then as someone gave you something written, as you learned to read, what was that experience like for you as someone who was just drawn to the language anyway, and then to see it in this new form and understand it in its new form?
I think that looking back, like, stories and language came to me in different forms and formats and expressions. As I'm growing up, so I was born in, I'll put it this way, since I was born in March of 1948, I can say with confidence that I was conceived in 1947. Okay, so I'm a baby mm-hmm. boomer, born 2 years after the end of World War II. And the year I was conceived was essentially the first year that televisions were sold commercially.
Mm.
And in 1948, the year I was born, suddenly there were not just a few thousand of these new inventions, but there were millions of them being sold around the country. And as a New Yorker, I was close to, I was in the media, one of the media capitals of the world. And that meant that I had access to television very, very early. And I would say that, that had a profound and beneficial effect on my life. My brother Vincent, who's younger than I am, just told me recently, he says, I've never regretted a single hour of watching television. And people would argue that television and other forms of technology are somehow at war with literacy, that they replaced literacy. But to me, in my life, they were complementary. So my first stories were probably cowboy stories, cowboy adventures, Hopalong Cassidy, but also, puppet shows, kid shows, Howdy Doody. And then nursery rhymes. And I actually have a copy on my shelf. I can see if I can reach it. Hang on.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 years old, I'm still living in New York City in a little apartment. I do remember being read to. And there was this, in 1950, there was a collection of children's stories, poems, rhymes, legends, nursery rhymes, that was published by a popular publisher called Whitman. they did a lot of publishing for children's stuff. And this is called Children's Stories, selected by the Child Study Association. And in it, there are it's quite a significant collection of 40 or 50 stories, like Puss in Boots. Hey, let me read you some copies, some examples.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was the there's a story of well, there are these poems by Robert Louis Stevenson, and there's a story of Noah's Ark, and there's the children's story of Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod, the lion and the mouse. So these are little parables and beast fables and things like that, and Aladdin and the Wonderful Lamp. So it was a little treasure chest, and there was a one story in particular. It's a poem about a boy and his shadow. It's called My Shadow. Hmm. And my mother, for years and years later, I mean into her 80s and 90s, could recite the first stanza. I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He's very, very like me from the heels up to my head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed. The funniest thing about him is the way he likes to grow, not at all like proper children, which is always very slow. For he sometimes shoots up taller than an India rubber ball, and he sometimes gets so little that there's none of him at all. He hasn't got a notion of how children ought to play, and can only make a fool of me in every sort of way. He stays so close beside me, he's a coward, you can see. I'd think shame to stick to Nursie as that shadow sticks to me. One morning, very early, before the sun was up, I rose and found the shining dew on every buttercup. But my lazy little shadow, like an arrant sleepyhead, had stayed at home behind me and was fast asleep in bed. So, and I remember this poem for years and years and years and years. And I was visiting Canada. I was doing a writing workshop in Canada, and I was actually in a little town in Ontario called Shakespeare, Ontario. It's near the town where they have the summer Shakespeare Festival, Stratford, Ontario. And damn it, if I didn't see a copy of this book. I didn't even know what the name of the book was. And it was called Children's Stories, so it was just kind of generic, so it would have been really hard to just kind of search for it. And I found it, and I purchased it, and I reread it. And I was astonished at how interesting the stories were. It's a very joyful experience re-experiencing those stories. And when I read that book, read that poem, and I looked at the end of it, and I said, holy shit, this was by Robert Louis Stevenson. Hmm. So I did a little research. I eventually wound up writing an essay called My Shadow, and it points out that this innocent little poem about a tiny boy who has this unruly shadow who kind of gets him in trouble and like won't act like other proper little children would, and he disappears and he grows tall and he stays behind in bed, and he has all these bad habits, all the things you wouldn't want to teach to a child, that this was written about within a year of the time that Stevenson published Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which is the ultimate story about the dark, I mean, the light and the shadowy personality of a human being.
Yeah.
How these can both be embedded in the same person. So I now have a very, very rich collection here at Poynter and at home of what I call the formative books. And those would be the books I read or were read to me from cradle like to about college. And I keep rereading them, and I keep seeing new things in them. And in X-ray reading, I describe what it has meant, for example, to reread Gatsby over the years, you know, 6 or 7 times. And mm-hmm. The text is mostly the same, and maybe we know a little bit more about the author than we did, but every time we reread something that was formative in our experience, we're probably going to see new things in it because our autobiography has changed since last we read it.
Yeah, and you pick up, yeah, it's just like as you sort of, as you age and change around a static text, making it not so static, it's like your antenna just tuned to different frequencies within that book.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so, which is why I think that sometimes, like, I understand why we ask high school students to read Gatsby, but I was a pretty smart high school student, probably naive in many ways in terms of experiences outside of school, sheltered and protected in lots of ways. But I was not equipped to understand what a powerful work of art and a powerful artifact of American culture Gatsby was and is.
And the, as you said, you're in high school, you're pretty precocious and smart in that sense. As a reader and a writer in the schools you were passing through, what were some early validations that you had that sort of pointed you down a path of a career in letters and writing?
I would attribute my development and my future success to the work of a single teacher. Although I was blessed with good teachers throughout my career at every level. But I had this eighth grade teacher at a Catholic school on Long Island, and he was a Franciscan brother. He was Irish. His name was Richard McCann, and he died in his 50s. I'm sure he smoked cigarettes most of his life. He was known to us. They chose names other than their given name. So he was Brother Aloysius. And I came to think of him and as an adult and as a professional, I actually reached out to him and we had 2 or 3 meetings in person when he was in his 50s and I was in my 40s, I guess. And he came to understand how much he meant to my development. And as an eighth grade teacher in an all boys school at that point, he did some things that were really novel and really different. One of the things he did was that he would read whole novels to us aloud. You wouldn't think he would do that with a group of like 30 or 40 like eighth grade boys. Right?
No, that would be
like really, really hard thing to do.
That would be an absolute nightmare.
No, but the school had good discipline. It was one of those tough Catholic schools and things like that. But aside from that, you know, he would, and I still know those stories. I still read those stories on occasionally. In one case, I wrote some pieces about a Catholic novel called Mr. Blue that had gone out of print. And as a result of, partially as a result of that activity, the book was republished by a small Catholic press. So that was one of the things he did. The other thing he did is that this was a school that without a library or resource center.
Mm.
But fortunately, the public library was a 5-minute walk from our classroom. It was essentially one block from our classroom. And he created a reading list which had about 50 books on it. And I don't know how often we did it, but we did it a lot, is we get to his class, and instead of sitting in a classroom for 90 minutes or whatever with the subject matter, boom, okay, get out of here, you know? And the idea was that you could go to the public library. You never know when he was going to show up, so you didn't fuck around, right?
Yeah.
And you either looked up these books, borrowed these books, or you found something that you thought was better, and you could go with that as well.
Huh.
And these were, some of these books I would think of would have been books for young readers, you know, like teenagers, but most of them were not. Most of them were serious novels, either historical stories or a thick novel called The Last Hurrah, which became a well-known movie, which was about Irish Catholic politics in the city of Boston. Really, really good story. And I remember finishing that book, borrowing it from the library, finishing it, and then like holding it in my hand and realizing that something like had really changed in my life.
Hmm.
That I had graduated from the Hardy Boys.
Right.
And Superman and Batman comics. Didn't mean I wouldn't still enjoy those things, but I understood that there was something beyond it that would probably be part of my life forever.
Last week when I spoke with Jennifer Nesline, essayist and founder of Full Grown People, it's kind of an online literary journal, she had a influential teacher in high school who would, she had read, been assigned the canon, so to speak, but then they were handed Alice Walker's The Color Purple, and, you know, she realized, like, that unlocked a whole new world, like, oh, you can do that in writing.
Yeah.
And that must have been kind of what, you know, when you held The Last Hurrah there, like, oh, that just unlocked an entirely new universe for you.
Yeah, very much so. And here's where it gets a little complicated, and there are some historical issues and technology issues to account for. So why was I attracted to The Last Hurrah? The primary reason was that I was gaining access, really for the first time, to the world of adult secrets.
Hmm.
So this has changed dramatically in American culture, maybe world culture. But the 1950s, I'm sure you've heard stories about the fact that Ricky and Lucy Ricardo were not permitted to sleep in the same bed. You know this, right?
Right. Yep.
She could not say she could not say the word pregnant. They could not use the word pregnant. She was expecting. And so the post-war 1950s America was very sanitized with some flashpoints to kind of counterbalance it, like Elvis Presley gyrating on the stage of Ed Sullivan's variety show, but they cropped him from the waist down, you know, so you couldn't see the naughty part. You know, and so in that environment, the only way you could get access to adult secrets was through reading. And you either read stuff that you weren't supposed to read, or else if you had a smart adult in your life, they would help you sort of make that step. And I think Richard McCann, he was a Catholic brother. He was a Franciscan, but he was no prude, and I think that as long as you knew that you were getting more and more of that, of those secrets opened up to you, there's the incentive to read. Neil Postman wrote a book that influenced me a lot called The Disappearance of Childhood. And he argued that in the 1950s and into the 1960s, there was a big separation between childhood and adulthood. But that what happened is that the culture began erasing those boundaries. And I think that's continued to happen. I wonder what the average age in the United States is of first exposure to hardcore pornography. I bet you it's shockingly young.
Yeah, I can say I was 12.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
I'm 36 now. I was 12 when it first appeared before me on a video cassette.
Yeah, and even if you're not looking for it, well, it's really to get access. It's I've got where's my phone? There it is. I mean, I it could be there in 10 seconds with digital technology and iPhones and iPads. And in my day, we thought it was daring in elementary school and even into high school to look up dirty words in the dictionary if we could find them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so now you have a world where I would argue that young people are exposed to the secrets of adult life way too early.
Yeah.
And with some detrimental effects. Now, I don't want to go back in time, but one of the consequences of this is that you no longer have to read anything or read very much in order to find out, discover the things that I discovered when I read Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
Or The Scarlet Letter. Or, you know, whatever it happened to be. So, I kind of, in an old school kind of way, sometimes I'm tempted to kind of mourn the loss of that, those kinds of discoveries. But maybe what's happening is that it's not just exposure to the adult topics like sex, death, violence, serious illness, betrayal, you know, those kinds of things. But maybe now it's reading can help a young person make sense of those things.
Yeah, and process it better.
Process it. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Learn how to talk about it. And certainly girls are way ahead of boys in that, you know, in that that category. If you go to a bookstore, you can see the gender differences in terms of the marketing of books, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, boys have access to graphic novels and those are the kind of works that are created for them. Girls have a much richer literature to draw upon.
So as you progress through school, where did you go to college, and how did you end up in Alabama for your first teaching gig?
So, you know, I was really interested in, I love sports, still do. Maybe not with the same passion that I used to, but I love basketball. I lived in New York. The Northeast was one of the basketball sort of, I don't know, regional centers. And so I would, my interest in colleges were first attracted to college athletic teams, basketball teams in particular. Princeton had a fantastic basketball team in the 1960s, led by a guy named Bill Bradley, who became, who was a presidential candidate at one time. He was a senator from the state of New Jersey, a Rhodes Scholar.
And, and McPhee wrote a book about him.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What's the name of that book? The Sense of Where You Are.
Yes. Yep.
And so I was a smart kid. I didn't think I could play basketball, you know, at Princeton. I mean, I was way beyond that dream. So I applied to Princeton. That was the only Ivy League school I applied to. I applied to a group of Catholic schools, Catholic colleges, and to my shock and dismay, I didn't get into Princeton. I was, I got the letter. I called, my mom got the letter. She opened it up. And it was a really, really sad day, that April day. April of 1966. I was a salutatorian at an elite boys Catholic school, and the valedictorian was a guy named Jeff Colucci, who was really smart. He was the best student in the school by far, and he was class president, and he was a track athlete, and he wanted to go to Dartmouth. And he didn't get in. We've talked about this years later. There's a conspiracy theory that says that the guidance counselors wanted all the best students to go to Catholic schools, Catholic colleges,
mm-hmm.
and so that they undermined the efforts to get into Ivy League schools. I now no longer believe that, but. It's been interesting to think about and talk about over the years.
Yeah.
So I wound up going to Providence College, and Providence had a great basketball school. So I knew them from that, and my high school teacher, my history teacher, who was also the basketball coach, was a graduate of Providence College. He's still alive, I just learned.
Hmm.
And named Jim Swartz. So I not only got in as I expected I would, but I got a very, very generous scholarship, what amounted to almost a full scholarship. Other teachers approached me and said, you know, you should really go to a better school. You can do better. But, you know, I grew up in a working class family. I had two younger brothers. This was a gift that I could kind of pay my mom and dad back for their support.
Mm-hmm.
To say, you know, let's do this. And it wasn't a great school, but it had an absolutely outstanding English department. And it had a very elite honors program, called Liberal Arts Honors Program. And I got really smart at Providence College by working with the teachers in the English department and the teachers who ran the Arts Honors Program. I mean, the Arts Honors Program was a fantastic experience. It was essentially a three-year, six-semester course, a great works course, mostly Western civilization, with some Eastern stuff, you know, included. But you read the Iliad or the Odyssey, like the first week, and then 3 years later, you were reading Freud and, I don't know, James Joyce.
Hmm.
So you read one book a week, and you were responsible for writing a 1,000-word essay on that book. And there were only 12 or 15 of you. You met for two and a half hours each week, and you had two teachers. One teacher was the one who ran the whole seminar, and the other teacher was like the best teacher on that book in the college.
Huh.
So, for example, if you read German philosophy, Hegel or Kant, there would be a teacher from the philosophy department who would come and work with the class. if you were reading Don Quixote, then someone from the Spanish department would come and work with you. Very intense, very intensive, kind of competitive, and I'm still in touch with some of the students from that program. A kid named Bob McIntyre, call him Bobby McIntyre, but of course he's a grown man now, who was a mathematics major who was in the liberal arts honors program, went on to become, I think, the founding director for a group in Washington, D.C., called something like the Institute for Tax Justice.
Huh.
Lindsay Waters, who was a year older than I was, but was still part of our liberal arts group, became one of the top editors at Harvard University Press in the humanities. Austin Sarrett, S-A-R-A-T, Austin Sarrett, went on to become maybe one of the most popular and influential political science kind of public philosophy teachers and scholars at Amherst University Press. And we done good. And
yeah, they made you really think and think about that stuff with a certain focus that just translated across professions.
Yeah. So the idea is that what makes you... There was a teacher at Stanford who came to the Poynter Institute one time for a program. I worked with her in a couple of projects. Her name is Shirley Bryce Heath, H-E-A-T-H. I'm not sure whether she's still teaching. I haven't been in touch in a while. But she asked me a question. It was very formative. She said to me, "What does it mean to be literate in America?" Really? Okay. What do you mean? Who are the most literate people in America? I said some smart ass thing like Shirley, like you and me? No. No, I said, no, famous people. And I just blurted out a couple of names. I said, I don't know, Susan Sontag and William F. Buckley Jr. And I realized that after I mentioned these two names, both of whom now passed away, that I couldn't, in many ways, I could not have chosen two more different individuals, man, woman, liberal, progressive, left, very conservative, on the right. She kind of, like, why have you mentioned these two people? I said, well, I'm not sure. She says, okay, what did they do that makes you want to call them literate? So she did this Socratic kind of questioning of me. And she told me, I said, look, there are these behaviors. And if you practice these behaviors, it marks you as literate. And what are they? Well, the first two are very, I think, are obvious. If you're literate, you read. And you read in certain ways. And if you're literate, you write. And you write in certain kinds of ways. But it's that third element that I think people underestimate or fail to see. And that is that if you are a literate person, you have the capacity to talk about how meaning is created through reading and writing.
Hmm.
So it's not just a matter of reading and writing. That would be good enough. That's two-thirds of the way there. But as you grow as a reader and as a writer, you gain the capacity to talk about how reading and writing works. maybe I could draw an analogy saying that if you're a highly literate and knowledgeable musician, you have the ability not only to read music and to play music, but you have the ability to talk about music, right?
Yeah.
And to talk about how certain movements in music affect the listening experience or stimulate the emotions in certain kinds of ways. What I say very often about Providence College is that I wouldn't say it taught me how to be a writer, but it certainly taught me how to be a reader and how to be a thinker and talker about how reading works and operates. And it was later that in graduate school and then in my in Alabama that the writing aspects kind of kicked in.
Yes, it looks like that the going right back to, you know, Robert McCann and then having this experience in Providence with these extremely literate teachers that like taught you the meaning, like the true meaning of literacy, that you were able to like translate that into your own style of teaching. And and so you bring that to, let's say, Alabama. So that's a big departure from New York City and Providence for sure. So what was that experience like, you know, bringing your sense and taste in literacy to a different region and to start exercising that craft you'd been honing for a few years at that point?
So, once again, I wanted to go to graduate school. I applied to, this time I did not apply to Princeton. I was still pissed. You know, I didn't want to belong to any club that wouldn't have me as a member. And so, but I applied to the other Ivy League schools, and I got into Brown University.
Hmm.
And I wanted to go to Brown. I was about to become engaged to be married. My future wife lived in Rhode Island, and I wanted to be as close to her as possible. The problem was that just could not afford to pay for an Ivy League education, even at the graduate level. You know, no scholarships, no fellowships available to me at that particular time. And I get a phone call, I get a letter from almost, I'd say, my old hometown university. So Stony Brook is part of the State University of New York system, one of the big campuses, known mostly for science. It's about 50 miles or so from Manhattan, out on the North Shore of Long Island. And they offered me a very generous fellowship. In other words, not just tuition-free, but also a stipend that I could apply to my living expenses.
Mm.
So it was once again money or decision about costs that drove me back to Stony Brook. Stony Brook was a dreadful campus and a very disorganized, crazy school back in the 60s and early 70s. Graduate school is kind of graduate school is really about narrowing. You know, I mean, if you broadened yourself in college, as you should, then you begin to sort of narrow your interests a little bit. Your intellectual interests, and also what you plan to do with your learning. And so I knew that I wanted to become an English professor. The English department at Stony Brook was good, had some quite famous scholars and professors. They had a small group of very, very good teachers in medieval literature. They became lifelong friends and colleagues, Donald Fry, Marty Stevens. I would wind up doing my dissertation on Chaucer it was another way of me, I wanted to sort of learn English literature and language from the beginning. And so that was a really good choice for me, as it turned out, both on a personal level. And it's like I wound up getting a PhD in English literature, concentration on medieval studies. I wanted to teach Chaucer, I wanted to teach Shakespeare, and other forms of literature, as happens at colleges and universities. And I got my PhD in 1974. I had a wife, and I had a child, my daughter Allison, named after a character in the Canterbury Tales. I applied to 100 schools. People forget, but if you wanted to apply to 100 schools back then, you had to type 100 letters.
Right.
And I got 4 requests for interviews, and it was during a very bad economy. 1974 was a very bad economy. There was the Arab oil embargo, long gas lines. The Vietnam War was finally coming to an end. The draft was over. You'd have to fact check this, but as I remember it, there was a kind of a glut of PhDs because people had extended their education to try to get student deferments from the draft so they wouldn't have to go fight in the jungles of Vietnam. So I interviewed, three, four schools, and I got one job offer, and it was in Montgomery, Alabama. People were delighted, a little surprised that I was considering it. My family was a little shocked, kind of thrown off balance. But, you know, I wanted to start a career. And a lot of the other kids, young people in their mid-20s, who just drew a 50-mile circle around Manhattan and said, here's where I want to work, they didn't get any jobs.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I could become, with a brand new PhD, an assistant professor at a branch campus of Auburn University in Montgomery, Alabama. And I have to say that professionally, in retrospect, it was the most important decision that I ever made. You know how, like, in the aftermath of this election, we're kind of thinking or talking about the way that Americans kind of maybe don't know each other the way we thought or the way they need to?
Yep.
Like that there are parts of the American experience that are completely hidden from other people. And so, yes, it was a cultural change. Yes, there were many different issues to be confronted on politics, race, region. Rather than it being, what it did for me was it just threw open the door of American culture, American language, American politics, race. If you think about it, I arrived there 6 years after the assassination of Dr. King, and a decade after the civil rights legislation was passed, and I could travel, I could stand in a place in downtown Montgomery, and I could look up the hill a little bit and see where Jefferson Davis was inaugurated president of the Confederacy. And I could look down the steps of the Capitol and see where George Wallace, who I had a chance to meet, by the way, where George Wallace had declared in a famous speech, segregation now, segregation forever. And then I could turn my head and look down the hill a little bit and sit. I think it's called, I think maybe the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. I think that's the name of the church, which was Dr. King's church before he, you know, went back to Atlanta. I could see the bus stops where the Montgomery bus boycott had been you know, brought to life, and it was like it was amazing history, which I had only the lightest kind of book knowledge. What it made me want to do was to write about what I was learning. I had the help of a very progressive group of journalists and other community leaders and church leaders in Montgomery, who were on the progressive side of the racial issue. I realized how courageous they had to be to take a progressive view, you know, as white people, take a progressive view on race in the South. And so I began to write. I began to write for the New York Times op-ed page. I began to write for other publications. And that was the doorway that led me from the academy to the journalism world. It created this kind of posture for me where I could have my left foot in the world of the academy and in the scholarly world, and I could have my right foot in the world of working journalists who were the chroniclers of American life, American democracy, and American culture. And I think I've spent my life, I'm not stuck in that position. It's just that I can go to my left, I'm like a basketball player, right?
Yeah.
I can go to my left, I can go to my right. And so that experience could not have been created. If I had stayed in New York or in New England, I'm sure I would have been in an English department for a while, you know, and I'm sure I would have been happy in lots of ways. The academy and English departments kind of changed after, you know, in the 1970s. I'm probably what would be called a modernist in a lot of my sensibilities. I think there is such a thing as a kind of a canon of literature. I think it needs to be enriched and expanded and diversified. The more extreme expressions of postmodernism kind of left me cold. And especially the scholarship on literature, when I tried to read it, it was so encrusted with jargon and so far from the joy of the experience of literature that I think many times I've thought, hey, you got out just in time.
Yeah. So how did you come to meet Gene Patterson?
So it was through the auspices of another Southern editor and journalist and editorial writer named Ray Jenkins. He's a member of a group of Southern editorialists who were more progressive on the issues of race and who had found their voice as agents of change in the South and who were people of moral and physical courage. And he befriended me, and I learned a lot from him. I told him after he helped me get my first essays in print in newspapers, and I told him that, you know, I think that I would like to expand my teaching capacity so that I'm teaching reading, I'm teaching writing, I'm teaching literature, I'm teaching language. I think I'd like to develop a course in journalism. And I started reading some books, kind of helped me think about that, think about how journalists do things. It was the first time I heard phrases like who, what, where, when, and why, and how, and first time I heard about this writing structure called the inverted pyramid. And we had talked about, we had planned maybe that I would do some work for the Montgomery Advertiser Journal, a newspaper there. And then he came to me and said, you know, I just talked to this editor, Bob Heyman, who works with a famous editor named Gene Patterson. And Gene is president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors this year. And he wants to start this writing improvement program at his newspaper. He's looking for someone who can help him do that. What do you think? Would you be interested in doing that? So it was as a result of that conversation between Bob Heyman and Ray Jenkins that led to my being asked to come down to St. Petersburg. And it was exactly 40 years last month that I made the trip from Montgomery to St. Petersburg and sat in a room with seven or eight men. They were all men at that time, who were sort of the journalism leaders in St. Petersburg and Florida. And Nelson Pointer, the owner of the paper, Gene Patterson, the editor, and they liked what they heard. They offered me, at a small increase in my salary, an opportunity to spend the year there working on this project. And then I was supposed to go back to the university. And I was completely ready to do that. And that 1 year turned into 40. And no looking back.
So what questions were writers asking of you then, and over the course of your career too, what questions do you most often field from writers looking to, even novice writers, or just anyone looking to improve? Like, what, you know, even like 40 years ago, what were you hearing? And then, you know, what were you hearing, you know, going forward in the ensuing decades?
Yeah, you know, the Pointer Institute republished the first essay I wrote about my experience in the newsroom. So 6 months into my experience, I wrote a couple of thousand words, as I recall, for the Bulletin of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. And what was really interesting is how my description of the problem as I first saw it has kind of retained its viability or its significance.
Yeah, and its relevance, for sure.
Its relevance.
Yeah.
And so it was just things like, it was things that were clarified for me by meeting another writing coach who was about my father's age, who came from the World War II generation. His name was Donald Murray, and after Patterson hired me, Tom Winship, who was the editor of the Boston Globe, hired Donald Murray to be a writing coach at the Globe. And Murray had actually won a Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in his 20s. He was a very young man.
Wow.
At the time. And Murray went on to be a very influential writing composition teacher and sort of writing theorist, if you will, practical theorist. So he became a kind of a papal figure for English teachers at every level. And he came to Pointer and he worked with me. He articulated some of these issues in ways that I couldn't quite see at first. So, for example, I'm about to echo Murray, saying that, you know, to the struggling writer, like good writing looks like magic. But it's not magic. It's a set of rational steps. You can learn the steps. You can learn the names of the steps. What's an example of a step? Well, every piece of writing needs a focus, a central idea, an organizing principle, a nut, a kernel of truth or emotion or feeling, an idea. And all the other parts of the work that you've written reinforce that in some way. And you could be writing a poem or a college dissertation, and ultimately you're still responsible for figuring out what this piece of writing is really about. Just that construct alone allows you as a writer or as a writing coach or as a teacher of writing or as an editor to kind of figure out what's happening when a piece of writing really works and what's happening when a piece of writing is in trouble. Now, I just talked about this in terms of a piece of writing, but that writing is produced by a human being. And the writer or teacher's responsibility is not just to perform autopsies on a cadaver, you know, to fix a broken story. It's to work with a human being, a creative human being, in order to help improve their craft, their techniques, to sharpen their strategies, to become a better reader, writer, and a better talker about reading and writing, so that you can step into the pathway of someone who learns something new about the craft every day.
Yeah, and so much of your book writing over the years, the fact that you wrote 5 books in 10 years on the craft of writing just blows my mind every time I think about it. It's a feat of generation, and not only just generation of material, but of just such valuable work to writers and readers alike. You've stripped down the artifice, like you said, like you showed. It does feel like magic to someone who doesn't know who hasn't been trained to see where the scaffolding was bolted into the side of the building, and like so much. So it's like what you've done is you've stripped a lot of that away to show, like, yes, this is very much attainable if you're willing to do the work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think here's more Donald Murray. Remember, Roy, a page a day equals a book a year. You know, what is that? Well, it's a kind of an aphorism, right, about writing. It's this kind of like little Zen-like saying. But it has practical implications, and it has psychological and emotional implications. So why is it that so many people who finish their PhD coursework and even their exams never get their degrees? Because somehow they lack the capacity to write the dissertation. And I think I could have had another career just coaching people on their dissertations so they could get their degrees. Because I think that people are paralyzed. I think they're paralyzed by their fear of, you know, the marathon, of the ideas that, oh my God, now I'm going to have, how am I going to produce something that has this 300 pages or whatever? You know, I can barely write a term paper.
Yeah, it's the bird by bird process.
Exactly right. And in fact, Don Fry, my dissertation director and became my colleague at Poynter, one of my best friends ever, he said, when I was getting ready to write my dissertation, he said, look, you can write a term paper, right? Yes. Okay. All right, here's what you're going to do over the next 4, 5, 6 months. You're gonna write 10 term papers. I looked at him funny. He said, "Do the math." The other thing he did for me is he got me to, at first, he was a very good editor, but at first he got me to lower my standards. You know, not to wait until all the research was finished before I started drafting something. You know, kind of the value of doing some exploratory writing. And I didn't have all the vocabulary to understand what was happening there. But looking back, that was clearly the case. And I don't think my dissertation was very well written, but I was able to generate out of it. I remember also at the time when I was at Auburn, you know, I think a half dozen journal articles, scholarly journals, at a time when I thought I wanted to be an English professor for life. I remember very vividly after my first experience with journalism is really sitting back and looking at the different lifespans of a piece of writing, how in the academy you could get an idea in 1974, you could research it in 1975, you could write an article in 1976, it could be accepted in 1977 and appear 78. So like there's this 5-year span between ignition, you know, and landing on the moon. Whereas in journalism, you could see something on television, sparked your interest, and you could write about it, and people in America could be talking about it 2, 3, 4 days later. And there was a whole different biorhythm, which sort of attracted me, I have to say. Orwell was an important figure because Orwell was a journalist, novelist, scholar, and Orwell wrote about politics and the English language. And language was central to works like 1984 and to all of his essays. I remember the first time I ever worked with a group of journalists before I went to St. Petersburg was in Montgomery through Ray Jenkins, and it was a seminar for Southern editorial writers. And I remember exploring sort of reading their editorials, looking at their use of language, looking at the distance between the language that was really fresh and the language that was really stale, talking about the relationship between language misuse and political corruption. Essentially, Orwell opened that door for me. So it was a good... And I've been, you know, faithful to him ever since.
Now, writing about writing, it's always going to draw a certain measure of attention to yourself. It's kind of like if you're a personal trainer, you can't be fat. And it's like, so if you're writing about writing, it's like the scrutiny is that much higher because you got to hold yourself to the standard you're writing about, and an even higher standard, because it's going to cause it. People are going to look at your work a little with a heavier eye, and I wonder how you approach that degree of scrutiny, given how much you've coached and how much you've written about writing over the years.
Yeah, that's a very important question. It's what I call. You used a good analogy. My version of that is the dentist with bad teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and the opposite was true. Like, so I have I come from a family where people have some chronic skin problems. You know, over the years, nothing dangerous, but a little. psoriasis or dermatitis or something like that, a little rash here or whatever, some milder forms of skin cancer since I live in Florida. But I remember going to the dermatologist for the first time, and the door opened up, and there was a woman who walked in. She was a young doctor. I don't think she's probably in her 30s. And I said to myself, I have picked like a really the best dermatologist in the world. This person, of all of God's creatures, has the most perfect skin I've ever seen. And then I kind of, you know, she was a fine doctor, but over the years I said, you know, maybe that wasn't right. Maybe it's the person who has the experience of struggling through something who can better identify with my circumstances. And so I think that about a week ago, just a few days ago, I dangled a modifier in an essay I wrote about Trump's definition of quotation marks. And there was a gleeful correction by, especially since the sentence in which I was, the sentence I had written had mentioned the fact that I had written a book on grammar. So to make a grammar or a usage mistake in a sentence where you're bragging about how good you are with language. So it's like that scene in Animal House where Kevin Bacon, you know, one of his early roles, he plays the cadet in the bad fraternity. And the vicious frat boys are paddling him. You know, and they smack his ass, and he says, "Thank you, sir. May I have another?" You know. So it was one of those moments. But you know, I got out ahead of it. I said I was going to leave the mistake up there for a couple of days, and you know, suffer the consequences. And I then admitted that I had done this on Twitter. People thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened in a case like that is, although nowadays there's always going to be some trolls, and there are going to be people who don't read your work very carefully and criticize it harshly. In general, if you have a reputation and a history of being a champion of writers, of identifying with the work of writers, their triumphs and their struggles, if you are always in the game, not just coming out of the hills after a battle and to shoot the wounded, that people are going to give you the benefit of the doubt. It's like you earn the right to be, you earn the right to make mistakes. And if anybody, I don't hide these, but if anybody could come to my office and look at a 350 or 400 word manuscript that I've written, and read the 1,000 or so marks that copy editors from Little Brown make on my manuscript. A lot of them are formatting issues or corrections, but yeah, there's my share of redundancy and awkwardness and insensitivity and lack of clarity. And so, I'm fortunate enough to have a team of people surrounding me, not just one team, but teams of people surrounding me, whose job it is to help me get my best work in print. And it's my mission to open the door for literacy and good writing wider and wider, so that more and more people can imagine themselves as belonging to communities of writers, nations of writers, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, because it's a team sport.
Mm-hmm, yes. Well, it's not only that, but let's say, I think people are thinking about this right now in a very harsh and contentious political moment, that we say things like we live in a democracy. We say things like we have freedom of expression. We talk about the history and the power of the First Amendment. And every day I walk into the Poynter Institute, every day for more than three decades, the last thing I see before I enter the building is this marble plaque with the words of the First Amendment on it. So I'm reminded, like, every day that there is this ideal against which I should always judge my own work and help others towards the fulfillment of that ideal in their work. What good is freedom of expression if we lack the means to express ourselves? And that's my articulation of a mission and purpose, both as a writer and a writing teacher.
Yeah, and that seems to be really at the core of, if you had to put an arc over the five books you've written in the last 10 years, you're giving a lot of nuts and bolts and strategies, help to find that community, mm-hmm. Grammar to hone to swim and live in the language, and writing short mm-hmm. for the internet, and then the X-ray reading of, like, let's get to that subterranean river that's going underneath a lot of these great works. It's like they all are there. It's kind of like a web, if you will, that are all kind of just feeding off each other in that sense.
My great college English teacher is a brilliant teacher, brilliant scholar, and a very generous human being. His name was Rene Fortin. He died at the age of 61. I never saw him, I don't think for a moment, including doing softball games, when he didn't have a cigarette in his hand. So, he died young, but not until he had, he filled me up with literature and language. And the first book that we read, so he was my college literature teacher, and I studied with him every year. I managed to find a way to do that. So I went ahead and in the first class, we read The Dubliners, a collection of short stories by James Joyce. And then the second book we read was Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which is a novel, kind of an autobiographical novel by James Joyce. And the third book we read was Lord Jim by Conrad. And the fourth book was another novel by Conrad, and I can't remember the name. All right. So I'm telling you this because he taught us this kind of little lesson, a sort of a theory. And the way he described it was that writers, especially great writers, wind up writing the same book over and over and over again. Now, that was a strategy that he used to allow us to look at, for example, look at the short stories by James Joyce, and then look at his novel. And he'd ask questions like, what evidence is there? If you didn't know, if these works didn't have anybody's name on it, how would you know that they belong to the same author? And that was a very invigorating question, sort of challenge for us. And so I am very much tuned in to your insight about these five books, that they are not, I wouldn't say that they are the same, they're five different books, but they form a kind of, without being a series, they form a kind of a coherent whole. And to figure out what that is, I think you have to use the big words. Words like literacy and language and learning and craft and discipline and close reading, but also culture, community, democracy. There's a scholar named James Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, who was the dean of journalism at Illinois and started the PhD program in journalism at Columbia. And his advice, he was a few years older than I was, he represented for me a slightly older generation of scholars. And he said, attach yourself, he said, a lot of scholars do attach themselves ultimately to very narrow little things. Not little things, but niches. Niches. Not Nietzsche, but niches. You know, slave narratives of the 1830s, you know, the South in the 1830s. Now, if you actually attach yourself to that topic and did it right, of course, you might be looking at a few writers and studying them in depth. But you'd hope, you'd almost be able to predict that that study would, could, and should lead you to big ideas about what America means, what its vision and ideals were for itself and its people, how it failed so miserably on so many occasions, how beyond those failures, there could be hope and progress. So yeah, I you know, it's funny. I have to make a decision as to whether I want to write another book or not. I assume that I will. I have some old projects that I've always wanted to sort of translate into book form, and I might work on some of those. But one of the interesting conflicts in my life as a professional, especially in the last 10 or 12 years, is that there's some writing that I think I would like to do, but that the writing would look very different from these five books. It might be a novel. It might be a play. I might write about a social issue. What happens is that when you become successful as an author in a particular field, it becomes very difficult to abandon that field for other kinds of writing. Does it make any sense?
Yeah, it's like being typecast.
Yeah, but it's beyond being type. Well, it is being typecast, but the idea is that. Is someone saying, okay, Clint Eastwood, right? You're making these great Westerns. You're really, really good at making Westerns. But I don't want to make Westerns. I want to make, like, a cop movie. Okay, but Dirty Harry's got to just... is going to be the same guy that you played, you know, in the spaghetti Westerns. Yeah, I like your analogy. But I think it more as being, if you're making... a series of, if you're, who's this guy? Is it Judd Apatow? Is that his name?
Yeah. Yeah. Comedy writer.
He was a comedy writer, right?
Yep.
So let's say that guy wants to make a very serious social drama.
Well, it's like when Adam Sandler did Punch Drunk Love. It's like out of context.
Yeah, and so if you have an agent, as I do, and editors, as I do, who also have investment in your success, what you hear is things like that when an author becomes an author who kind of has become one of the authors that sort of dominates a kind of a category, like Stephen King, right? Stephen King wrote a really good book on writing.
Yeah.
But it's notable for its difference to everything else he's done. And so Donald Hall, the poet, very versatile writer, once said about Donald Murray, they're both from New Hampshire, as I recall, and Hall said about Murray, "Don Murray is a very good writer, about writing." And I said, oh boy, that's a really interesting compliment. But it's also a critique. It's a critique of the writing that Murray did that was not about writing, his poetry and his novels and his, you know. And so at the age of 69, am I satisfied in being, you know, a decent and influential writer about writing? And I'm saying, yeah, that'd be cool. That's not a bad legacy. But as somebody who created that legacy by devoting himself to the craft and by learning new things about writing, I don't think I'm going to be able to continue that journey just by writing about writing alone. That I need some other moves, and I'm working on it a little bit.
And when you're in the throes of that creative process or generating pages, what does your routine look like? You know, your morning routine as you're sort of gearing up the engine to try to get a good day's work done and win the morning and win the day.
I can write fast. And I can write earlier than other people, but I don't mean earlier in the day. I mean, I can begin the process before other people would think I'm ready. So I think some people have called it, I like zero drafting. I like, so I might write about Chuck Berry today or tomorrow. You know, I have an essay in my head saying, you know, what I learned about writing from listening, from growing up listening to Chuck Berry. And I can say, now I have to learn a bunch of stuff before I could publish an essay on that title. I have to learn a lot about him. I have to study his lyrics. I have to listen to some of the music. I probably have to play some of it myself to remind myself what it feels like. I could do all those things. But I could sit down right now and give you, in an hour, 1,000 words on Chuck Berry. And what that draft would do, because kind of not even a first draft, looking like a zero draft, that draft would teach me what I know and what I think, but it also teach me what I need to learn. As a general method for a short piece of writing, like a piece of daily journalism or daily reflection or kind of an act of public scholarship or whatever, that's the way I like to work. When I'm working on a project, a book project, it's very important for me to identify the units of construction, the smallest unit of construction. So in the case of writing tools, that smallest unit would be a 800 to 1,000 word essay on one tool. What's good for me, and I need to create 50 of those units to have 50,000 words and have a book. At some point, what's going to work best for me and make me most productive is when I get into a mode where I'm just cranking out those units without paying too much attention to their quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lowering that bar of perfection.
Yep, lowering the standards early in the process. Because I know that the hardest part is not writing the good sentence, or, you know, the hardest part is getting 300 pages under your belt. Now, if I think about it that way, it doesn't work very well for me. But if I sit down on a Monday morning and begin a chapter, maybe come back the following day and the following morning and finish it up, I'm kind of a 1 to 2 hour writer,
mm-hmm.
which is to say that prefer the mornings in general. I used to do it earlier. Now I do it a little bit later in the morning. So mid-morning is a good time for me. From mid-morning to noon, I can either write a column, short essay, draft of a chapter, you know, those kinds of things. As I get more and more into a project and I'm capable of seeing the parts, what I try to do is that I map these. And the way I map them is that I can't do it so well in my office because I've moved recently. But in my old office, I had a big tack board, bulletin board. And so if I have an idea of a book, here's a good example. Let's say my next book is going to be the 100 greatest writing books of all time. Okay?
Yeah.
So I've got a collection of most of those. So if I wanted to write that book, what I would do is probably on index cards, I would write the names of the book at the top, the author, and maybe one sentence on the card that reminds me of why I selected that book. And then I'm going to tack it up on the board. And then over time, you're going to see 100 of those up on the board. And corresponding to those will be paper files as well as computer files, which has William Zinsser's On Writing Well. And I'll be able to, you know, and so once I get the materials, it's a combination of kind of creating a kind of, I don't know, the equivalent for this kind of book of a storyboard where you can see the parts all at once. One of the things I don't like about, one of the incapacities to me of word processing is that it's really hard to do that sometimes. The screen's not big enough really to give you that full vista, that full vantage of the parts of a project.
What's nice the only way to maybe get around that is to like maybe print out a page and you're done. That way you can start to see a pile grow, and that way you actually feel there's substance and not just pixels of what you're doing.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
And it's with books on writing, I feel that writers of any any degree of skill, and novices especially, that it's very easy to say, like, oh, I'll start my project, whatever that is, you know, after I'm done reading this. And then it's a way of productive procrastination, because you're learning very valuable insights, but you're not putting it into practice per se. But you also need to be mindful of, this is kind of a continuing education thing, a sharpening of the saw, if you will. And I wonder how you balance that continuing ed portion of, like, writing about writing or reading about writing, and then also making sure that you sit down and do the work too.
Yeah, I think that goes back to the first book length work I wrote was my PhD dissertation. And let's see, yeah, I'm staring at, so I have, there's a bound copy in my bookcase. I'm looking at it right now. And I'm looking at it, I can see it has a black cover, but it looks like a book. I have no idea how many pages are there. All hand-typed, that's how it was created. Although this may be a copy of it, I'm not sure. But so Don Fry, my dissertation director, and his wife, who was an archaeologist, went to Greece the summer of 1974 to work on a project, archaeology, classical studies. So he was not going to be around very much for me to consult. These days, no problem. We just, you know, Skype each other or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But back in the day, if you were in Greece, you were in Greece. You were not available. What I remember is he was saying, come on, let's get this thing done. Let's get this thing done. And he gave me this coaching about breaking it up into these term papers and then writing these term papers and slapping them together, writing an introduction. And it basically gave me a way in which to be productive, and I just did whatever he told me, and I got to it. And then what was interesting is that I had a 5-person committee reading the dissertation, and there was a debate. There was one member of the committee who didn't think that the dissertation was strong enough, that it was missing some important bits of research. There was a conversation, and they made a decision that they would approve the dissertation, but that during the dissertation defense, rather than making it a gentle, happy little party, as was the custom at Stony Brook, that they were going to cross-examine me. They were going to make me defend what I had written.
Mm.
And so I had one of the most contentious defenses, apparently, in the history of the English department there at the time. which I said, I wish somebody had whispered in my ear so that I'd been better, like, prepared for it. The point was that not one day in my entire life, since 1974, has anybody made any reference besides myself to the fact that I hadn't written the most perfect dissertation in history. In other words, there are times when you don't have everything that you could have, or all the material in the background that you need, and it's not going to matter that much. I do believe in a form of over-reporting, which to say that it's better for you to have done a little too much reporting than not enough. But that being said, if the effect of too much reporting is that you miss deadlines or you don't get to the work or you're not productive enough, then I think you have to reimagine your process and your craft. And all I'm saying is, if you do some research, come on back and sit down and write about it for a while. Just write about it for yourself. Send a message to yourself. Send a memo to yourself. Send a memo to a friendly reader. And learn what you need to learn in order to take the next step in the process. In most cases, you'll be shocked to discover you have enough for a paper, you have enough for an essay, you have enough for a book. And if you don't, if some test reader or copy editor thinks that you don't, there's still time to get what you need.
Yeah, it's easy to be crippled by and paralyzed by research, always thinking like you need just one more source, like I got to go to one more source, where primary or a person, mm-hmm. and it's going to round it out perfectly. But honestly, it's like you'll always find an excuse to try to find one more person if you can. But it's like kind of like what you were saying earlier, like writing before you're ready is also a good way to break that chain of that information flood. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to paraphrase what you just said, and I think it's true. I would say, put it this way, too often, more research is an excuse for not writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me just get you out of here on this note. Like, where, where can people, find you online and continue to follow your work?
Thank you for asking. I'm an old school guy, but I do have. I've been encouraged by my younger colleagues to become more active on social media. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter, which I really enjoy using as a form of expression. So I'm at Roy Peter Clark on Twitter. I am formally retired from full-time work, but I still publish essays on the Poynter Institute website, and that's Poynter with a Y .org, P-O-Y-N-T-E-R .org. Google search my name, and you'll find plenty of stuff there. Check me out on Amazon. If I can pimp my books just a little more, for reasons I can't exactly explain, I'm happy to say that lately, Amazon and some other booksellers, but especially Amazon, have been offering my book at a significant discount. So I think Writing Tools is available these days, the new 10th anniversary edition, for about $7.
Hmm.
And that's great. That's great. I'm very, very happy about the way Little Brown has published and marketed my books and the way Amazon has sold them.
Fantastic. Well, Roy, this was such a pleasure for me to get to talk to you and talk shop. Thank you so much for carving time out of your schedule to do this. This was a lot of fun.
Hey, Ben, listen, that's been great, Ben. I appreciate your reaching out to me, and I wish the best to all the writers who'll be listening to this.
Hey, what's this? An outro? Yeah, that's right. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you made it this far, all I ask for you is to share the episode, subscribe on iTunes or Google Play Music, like the hashtag CNF podcast page, and follow me on Twitter. That's actually a lot of stuff, and if you could do a quarter of it, I'd be happy. But also, do you know someone who wants to be on the show? You got a good guest idea? Do you want to be on the show if you're a writer of nonfiction? Just email me. Also, since you made it this far, I'm happy to give you a free editing consult. Just email me. I didn't tease that out on purpose. It's that simple. And lastly, a quote from my favorite all-time movie. Stay cool. Stay cool forever.